Well, I think I'll make a start. I'm shocked that you're here, but in a strange way, grateful. My name's Bill, and I've had the privilege of serving on the board here at Mount Tambourine Convention for a while, and part of that sparked my interest in how the gospel came to this part of the world. And another part of that interest is that there's a whole lot of things that you really need to get your head around as far as this property goes. And I just started to wonder, well, I wonder who owned it before and before that and what's happened here and, you know, all those sort of questions. I'm an inquisitive type. The second thing I'd like to let you understand is how stupid it was of me to present a history elective to a bunch of older people. But regardless of that mistake, I'm going to share some of them will be facts, and I'm sure you'll be able to sort me out. But before I start, let's open in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this place. We thank you for the fact that it's a place set aside for the proclamation of your word and the gospel. Lord, we thank you for those that have gone before, particularly those even that have gone a long way before in bringing your word to this part of the world. Lord, help us to learn from some of their experiences. And I pray, Lord, that you'll encourage each person here this afternoon in whatever chapter of life they're in as well. In your name, amen. So, this is a history elective on how the gospel came to Moreton Bay. And I call it Moreton Bay because Moreton Bay was here before Brisbane was here, and it was all Moreton Bay before it was ever Queensland. So the focus, the time period that I'm looking at is really around, primarily around the 1830s. Now, I know some of you probably have memories of the 1830s. Now, somewhere along the way, on the committee for the event, I heard them say, look, we need a mature presenter for the history elective. And I said, well, I'm amateur, and they misunderstood what I said. And so that's how I came into this, presenting this talk today. Now, just bear with me while I work out how this works. Another reason that I wanted to present this talk to you is that it has a great influence in interdenominational ministry. It was influenced by interdenominational ministry, which again is very much our DNA up here at Mount Tambourine Convention. So we kind of have a rough idea how it works for us, but how on earth did it work for them in the 1830s and who was involved? I find all these things fascinating. Here's my bibliography. There's many, many more sources than on that list, but I particularly want to draw your attention to the final one, which is my fertile imagination. Most of what I'm going to share is grounded in historical evidence. Some of it is not, and I'm not sure which bits are and which bits aren't. So please don't quote me anywhere in the future. Right. In the lead up to the 1830s, there was a lot going on in the world. And this talk, again, will focus in on what was going on in Prussia and England, Scotland and Australia. So in England, you had the Industrial Revolution. They were a major international trader. You had the War of 1812. Does anyone remember who fought in the War of 1812? Napoleon. And where was he?
Mexico.
Well, I think I could be right here that he was actually fighting in Russia. And Yeah, but that wasn't written until the 1860s, I don't think. But fun fact along the way, one of the major things that wiped out the troops after the retreat in 1812 was typhus. And typhus was contracted through fleas and things like that. So fun fact to remember for later in the story. That is supposed to be... My mistake. That's right. Thanks, Ken. Now, the Opium Wars came in the late 1830s. And the Opium Wars, of course, where the Chinese got tired of the English showing up and giving them opium in return for their silver. And after a good while, they thought, that's not going to help us out. Of course, the English had lots of opium to sell because they held places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and other parts of the empire. George IV and William IV, that was the time of their reign. So, what was going on in England? Also in England, there was a group called the Clapham Sect, which included people like William Wilberforce and Henry Thornton, and they were working hard for the abolishment of slavery. They promoted missionary work at home and abroad, but they were quite different to the more Wesleyan anti-slavery people in that the Wesleyans were really focused in on the poor in society. The Clapham sect, they were mostly the well-to-do English Church of England-y types that God got a hold of and got them well engaged. They were influential in establishing the London Missionary Society, which was in... Yes, it was in London, but when? When was it established? Call it out. Be proud. So close. 1795, London Missionary Society was established. And that was one of the first in Europe or that part of the world. In the European continent, things were far more complicated. Industrial Revolution arrived later, of course. French Revolution from 1789 and Napoleonic, concluding with the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. Finished off at the British and Prussian forces at the Battle of Waterloo, etc. How did you learn some of this in history when you were at school? I doubt very much we learn much about it in history anymore. But I find it all very fascinating. In Europe, they were also post-Reformation, and there were still a lot of struggles going on between Protestants and Catholics and different areas flip-flopping back and forth. German evangelical influence. So this is where we're really honing in on the part of the church that said, we've got a gospel to share, and we don't care particularly what denomination is going to do it, we're going to support them. So in broad terms, that's who I mean when I say the evangelicals. So in the 1800s, it was becoming quite popular. The Berlin Missionary Society kicked off in 1824. There was no German Missionary Society because they basically operated as cities. Germany wasn't Germany in those days. There was... Well, I'll show you a map in a couple of minutes. So a fellow named James Cook. Anyone know what denomination he was? Anglican. Anglican. He was cruising around the world, and he's the first guy from that part of the world that had a look at Moreton Bay. Of course, he ended up mapping much of the east coast of Australia back in the 1770s. Fun fact, does anyone remember the name of his botanist? Does anyone know what denomination he was?
Quaker?
They're all good guesses. Who said Brethren? Now, the Brethren hadn't been invented yet. The poor old church didn't know how good pre-millennialism and pre-trib and all those sort of things were going to be. So he was actually a Freemason. So the Freemasons had a look at this part of the world before most of the rest of the denominations ever had a look. And he wasn't alone. I'll tell you who else was with him. Sometimes this button seems to work. So John Oxley, anyone know what church he was part of? Freemason. Freemason. So I'm told. I mean, I'm just reading stuff. I wasn't there. But do your homework. Do your homework.
This is like a repeat of the American president. So all Mason.
So you'll notice on the map, Cook never went into Moreton Bay. If you're on the other side of the world to your home port, and there are no ports here, what do you reckon happened to the average ship that got stranded on a rock or something? End of the road. So I'm no mariner, but I'm pretty sure those numbers across the map are depth of water. They're constantly checking the depth of the water. And so the decisions about where they go would have been highly influenced by that. Cook never went into Moreton Bay. Oxley did. And his first trip, I think, they mapped the bay and then they discovered the river and started having a good look there. The river was quite shallow at the mouth and wasn't until, I believe, the Brisbane flood of 1893 or 1898. Some of you remember that one. That the depth of the Brisbane River apparently was scoured out.
And a lot of jelly
night, probably. It was the way it was in those days. Now, here's some of Oxley's work from the 1820s. And what's interesting is you can see where he mapped, and then you can see a different coloured line. The one in red is where the river actually is, and the one that he drew was pretty close, wasn't it? 10 out of 10 for effort, I reckon. You're in a little boat cruising up a river trying to map it out. A very good effort. So that was them. Bellevue Hill, or Goat Hill there, that was one of the early names, I believe, of Mount Cutha. Does that look about in the right place? Okay. So just to be clear, there were no other whites in the area in these days, although one of Oxley's trips, I think it was his second one, they were coming down past the bottom tip of Bribie Island and a couple of white fellas showed up waving wildly. And they'd actually been down past Sydney in a small boat out. They were, I believe they were timber cutters or something, and they'd gone to get some timber, got caught in a storm, taken out to sea, and they thought they were coming back in close to there, and they ended up stranded up here in Moreton Bay. So they were exceedingly glad to see our Freemason buddy. This ship here is the first one that brought convicts to the area. And I don't know if you know why they were looking for extra places to put convicts besides places like Sydney and other places. But Sydney had a very unique story, I'm told, of rehabilitating lots and lots of convicts. They had people with big hearts that got them through their time and working in jobs and becoming early Australians, really. I realise that there was no such thing as an Australian yet, but, you know, becoming normal. And the word about how good the convicts got looked after ended up getting back to England, and a lot of people, the convicts, weren't so scared of coming to Port Jackson or Sydney, and so they thought, well, we've got to get a serious place here that's going to be hard yakka. So they actually looked at one up at Gladstone first. Curtis Island was going to be the settlement, but it ended up here initially at Redcliffe, and then in Brisbane in 1825. Am I going too slow? Okay, you still with me? Anyone asleep? Okay. Well, the penal settlement was from 1824 through to 1842. And some of these dates are a little bit rubbery in that not all records tell you the same stuff. But roughly, it's kind of right. First man of God, shall we say, or minister in the area, or missionary, was a Reverend John Vincent. and he was very much of the British upper class minister kind of mindset. And you can see on the map, you had the commandant's office, the commandant's cottage, and just on the other side was the parsonage. So he was like the other ruler, or the other guy in charge. So it's not really what we have in mind when we're talking about evangelical missionaries, and details about his work I won't go into, but he was at war with the commandant most of the time, and it didn't all go well. Some of his furniture didn't arrive in the shape that he thought it should have, and he needed a bigger house and stuff like that.
Is it true that he lived to 102?
Is that what it said?
102 years.
It'd be unlikely that he lived anywhere near that long. Sorry, those are the years that he was the chaplain. Yeah, very short-lived. Yeah. Then there was another chaplain. And again, I won't go into too many details, but none of them were focused on the what they called the blacks. That wasn't really on the radar. And again, quite short-lived. One of those early chaplains, it might have been the next one, actually drowned with the missionaries, but I don't go into that story. It's just a fun fact. Now, different to the maps of Moreton Bay, this is the map of Northern Deutschland, and it was full. The circle on the right or in the middle is Berlin, and I've just circled down here is a town of Halle, H-A-L-L-E, where there were predominant theological colleges, mostly Roman, and that's where our people were influenced. Right, so one of the former Roman Catholic priests in Austria, his name was Gosner, Johannes Evangelista Gosner. Now, this guy, Gosner, is the key guy in bringing the gospel to the locals here in this part of the world. He was a student of Martin Buber and Johann Michael Saylor. Those names will likely mean nothing to you. They were... I won't say they were Roman Catholic teachers, but they were within the Roman Church. Many people disagreed with Catholicism that was still in the church. And I'm saying all over Europe, groups of people were flip-flopping, are we in and out? There wasn't a clear choice of you're in or you're out. So they were all flip-flopping, but it was these guys, if you study Martin Buber or Michael Saylor, you'll pick up they had an evangelical heart. They were keen about the gospel, and it didn't matter if they were working with the Lutherans or the Moravians or whoever they needed to work with. So it's quite a very different scene to what I would have expected before looking into it. That was that Gosner, who I mentioned, that was the church that he ended up the pastor of. That church was in downtown Berlin. It's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, or it was. It was completely destroyed, I think, in Second World War, about 1943. But if you go there today, on part of the property, there's a skeleton structure just made of steel that the Berlin government has paid to have there, and it's got the story of the Berlin Bohemian Bethlehem Church. Which is quite fascinating. And that place represents the home church of the missionaries that brought the gospel to Moreton Bay. Now, another interesting character, this guy is more well-known in Australian history, John Dunmore Lang. Hand up if you know loads about John Dunmore Lang. Loads? No? Hand up if you know loads. Okay, that's good. He was a fiery character, I've read, and some would have said he's a little bit unhinged. He was one of those guys that was very enthusiastic, confident, aggressive in his ideas. He got things done, And the things that he got done sometimes worked and sometimes they did not work at all. But he was a mover and shaker. He was a Presbyterian clergyman based in Sydney, and he was also a member of Parliament. He was a political activist as well and supported the creation of Australia being independent from England, and he was a very strong Republican. His family, he and his family are Scottish, so that explains the Republican tendencies. Now, at his church, there was obviously a strong young adults group, and Gosner was extremely keen to be doing what the London Missionary Society had started doing, that is sending missionaries all over the world. These are the young people that put their hands up to say, I'll go. I'll go to the other side of the world to take the gospel to a bunch of blacks, is basically what they were doing. Interesting, another fun fact, if you like, Charles Darwin, do you remember him? Okay, so in the 1830s, he was on his beagle cruising around the world and coming up with all kinds of theories and things. Interestingly, he stopped at one of the islands in the South Pacific where London Missionary Society staff had been at work very successfully for a long time. And he comments in his journals how wonderful these people were, and he calls them this is the converted locals on these islands. He raved about it being the most wonderful culture that he'd come across in the whole area. This is in the 1830s. Subsequent to that, he obviously came up with his theories, many of which seemed to exclude and challenge things that were held by many Christians. And one of the things that he suggested was that there were different levels of humanity, a journey towards humanity. And if you look at the artwork from the 1860s, and by the time he published Origin of the Species, the Englishman looked very much like the most developed guy. If you come back one or two on the way down to the apes, you'll notice that they look uncannily like the indigenous folk in this country. So between the 1830s and the 1860s, Darwin had helped to create a scientific justification for racism. And it was a very interesting journey. There's lots of info around that. Other interesting fun fact is if you have a look at the right column, these are the qualifications of the young people that went from Gosner's church. And to me, it's a fascinating list of trades. I mean, why would you want a tailor and a shoemaker on your missionary trip? Well, the answer is there was no shop. Closest shop, Sydney, supplies, extremely expensive except for a few commodities. So if you couldn't make stuff, you didn't have stuff. So the 1830s in Moreton Bay was rough. If you didn't carry it with you, you didn't have it. If you didn't find it on the ground, it was nowhere. Medic came in very handy. Gardener, yep, weaver, stonemason. There were two ministers. One was trained, neither were trained by Gosner. There was another society, the Basel Mission Society, based in Switzerland, that had been going for a few years before that. They had a slightly different emphasis to Gosner. Gosner was very much what he called the godly mechanic model of missionaries. In other words, if, say, I was a piano removalist, or no, say let's say I was something more practical, like a carpenter or a mechanic, I would go to the mission field and I would fix up those things and I would just help out the church in that capacity. The Basel Missionary Society and the London Missionary Society and many others, they were very keen to get people theologically trained, more like ministers, so they would handle the scriptures very, very well. But out of the group of, there were 12 of them that went initially, out of that group, two of them were trained ministers.
Wagner, Zillman and Rody, they're all around.
Don't steal my thunder, man. Yeah.
Am I jumping ahead of
you? You are. It's not fair. Let me go on. Can you tell me when I'm halfway done? With time, I mean.
5 minutes.
To go, or I have done 20?
5 minutes.
Oh, okay. Good. All right. So, how did they get from Berlin to Moreton Bay, you might ask? Very hard trip. Anyone know when steam engines were the railway was laid out in Germany? Anyone? After England, if that helps? Late 1800s. Okay, so this was long before that. My guess is that they would have gone by some sort of horse or coach or walk, one or the other. So from Berlin to Hamburg would have taken them a good while. Some of them were married. Most of them were married. Some of them were single guys. There was no single women that went on the walk.
Sensible.
Then they jumped on a boat. Now, this is Google Maps. So it shows if you've got to drive it in a car, you'd follow the blue line. If you're lucky enough to have a boat, you just go in the nice direct line. But Leith is just south of Edinburgh. So they went to Leith first. Then they jumped on one of these. Now, that was the predecessor to the railway. A railway still hadn't come to Scotland or England. Canals were all over the place, pulled along by whatever you could get to pull them. And that's how they got to the other side of Scotland, over to Glasgow, where they actually stayed with relatives of John Dunmore Lang. The people that I'll finish the story up with focusing in on, they stayed with Lang's mother-in-law in Glasgow. Now, Greenock was the port near Glasgow, and that is where they got on their boat to go to Port Jackson or Sydney or whatever it was called at the time. Now, in the advertising, it said, the fine first-class Bristol-built ship Minerva, it was 380 tons. Do you know how big a cruise ship is today? About 70,000 tons. So we're talking a little bouncy boat heading off. It all looked good though. First class would have been comforting, I'm sure. Let me read to you a little bit from the logbook of that trip. Oh, no, I won't. I'll just tell you, the logbook is available. It's a lengthy document. I'll read a little bit from a couple of other documents. Actually, the logbook, if you were to look it up, and I can give you the link if you want, it lists every day what the winds were doing, who was sick, who wasn't, who was frustrated, and it's a fascinating insight into journey at that time. So, let's see what's interesting here. Took them four months, roughly, on this ship. You scroll down because there was a... Here we go. By the time they arrived at Port Jackson, it was January 1838. The ship was not allowed to proceed up to the harbour in Sydney because typhus fever was on board. Instead, she went to Spring Cove, which is just near Manly on the other side of Port Jackson in Sydney. Now, a lot had transpired on that trip, and I will read to you a little bit about that. This is a quote. Having stated the particulars of voyage which lasted for 19 weeks or 4 months and a half, you may be anxious to know... Oh, this is a report by another passenger on the ship. You may be interested to know if we were comfortable on our passage. You will, I have no doubt, be sorry when I inform you that I never was so uncomfortable a state as when on board the ship Mervana. Our governors were inhumane, their regulators were bad, and the food which necessity compelled us to consume was such as produced the effect so lamentable to many in the death of their friends and nearest relatives. The sugar was sandy, the meal and flour decayed, the tea of the most inferior quality. In short, all the provisions were of the same stamp and calculated to shorten human life. They were given out in quantities barely sufficient to sustain our existence, hence the reason that they who arrived at Spring Cove were in such a weakly state. I would advise any immigrant to investigate into matters much better than I did. Now, what was actually going on the ship was a severe outbreak of typhus. The ship had a doctor on board with his extended family. The doctor's father, wife, and child all died of typhus, and the doctor became so unwell he could no longer look after anyone on the ship. So the medic in our team felt compelled to fill those shoes. Now, he was married to a lovely lady named Dorothy. By the time, well, they lost 86 people out of, I think it was about 360 on the ship. No, it wasn't, 190 on the ship. That's a very large percentage. So there was room on the ship when they got into port, but they were in a terrible state. And I reckon if it had happened today, you imagine the news about a disaster like that. It was gut-wrenching. They get into Port Jackson. They're not allowed to Sydney after 4.5 months on this dreaded ship. They end up in a quarantine station that only had makeshift building, probably with tarpaulin sides and things that had only been there for a few years before they arrived. And pretty much left to recuperate as best they can. While they're in quarantine, our missionary medic passes away from typhus, having given up all the luxuries of life in Berlin to serve in Moreton Bay. He gets as far as quarantine station and his life here ends. His wife, Dorothy, at that point, I would suggest was feeling rather down. They had about 3 weeks in quarantine before they were told that their ship to Moreton Bay was ready and that they were cleared to move. Hang on, I'm jumping ahead a little bit now. That's where the quarantine station was and still is. There's historical things there. Has anyone visited quarantine station there? Yeah, I haven't, but I would like to. Sydney Heads, yeah. So it wasn't easy to be a missionary to Moreton Bay, let me tell you. Now, this is an article out of the newspaper of the day, and it says there, concluded, I think it was one of a series of articles that was concluding. It wasn't that the mission had concluded at this point. So this is from 1838, and it reads, the German mission to the Aborigines at Moreton Bay, under the superintendence of the Synod of New South Wales, will be conducted somewhat on the principles of the Moravian missionary settlements in Greenland, South Africa, and the Nicobar Islands in the East Indies. It will consist of Reverend Schmidt, a regularly ordained clergyman of the Prussian Church, educated at the University of Halle, that I pointed out on the map, and Berlin, and the Reverend Eiper, a native of the Kingdom of Wittenberg, educated at the Missionary College in Switzerland, and ordained jointly by the Lutherans and Presbyterian ministers of the German and French Protestant churches in the city of London. So you get the idea, these churches were actually doing a lot of work together. The evangelical mission spirit was alive and well in those days, amongst some. Obviously, the majority were not so engaged, but amongst some. So they were going to set up a mission in a similar setup to the Moravians. It was not a Moravian mission. So there's been confusion about that over the years, but most of you probably care very little about that confusion. And if I hadn't have just mentioned it, you'd have been quite happy to not know. I'm sure my wife would have been quite, yep, happy not to know. All right, next slide. Now that is the Isabella. That's the one that they were told to hop on after their about 3 weeks in quarantine and coming out at the end of typhus. Did I mention typhus is passed on by fleas and things like that? So you can imagine the conditions in these ships. Terrible.
Is it the same as typhoid?
No, it's different, but I can't tell you exactly what the difference is. Yeah. It's probably related. The Isabella was half the size of the Ravana, and I reckon if I was Dorothy, having just lost my husband and having had a sort of a hell on earth experience for 4.5 months on a much bigger first class ship, how would I feel about hopping back on and going to Moreton Bay? Probably not very enthusiastic, but she did. Now, when they arrived in 1838, there were no maps of the land around Brisbane. This is a trigonometry map. Do you know what that is? Just they work on angles. So they stand somewhere and say, there's something I can see in the distance that's clear. I'll mark that according to what angle it is, and then we'll figure out distances. I'm not an expert on this. Somehow they figure out distances. Now, I put two circles. You can see where Moreton Bay is out there with a bit of blue and the Brisbane River. Where I've circled at the top, on the 1840 map, are the small words German missionaries. That's where the mission was, which is in the Nunda area. The other thing of interest that I put on the map is the yellow circle down here, I believe, is right here, because this end of the mountain is visible, well and truly visible from Brisbane where they were looking. The one with lots of lines coming off it there, I think it's Mount Forbes, and I don't know if that's been renamed, but the one up there near the top yellow is Sir Henry Taylor, and that's the one that's now renamed Mount Cuthah. Yeah, and they named a lot of the peaks after the early governors like Mount Cotton and Petrie and Logan and stuff.
In Auckland, you've got Dunmore Terrace and you've got Lang Parade.
I'll tell you more about that in a sec. You're not coming at 4 o'clock as well, are you?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm repeating that. They got a
start. Okay. So, yeah, that's just a zoom in. That's where the German missionaries were marked on that map, where Eagle Farm was. Now, when they were given that land, there was no road between there and Brisbane. There was no road from there to anywhere. One of the reasons they were given that block of land by the government to use, not given the land, though it was set aside for their use, was because it was deemed to be far enough away from the prisoners that it wasn't going to interfere. And the missionaries too, they were smart enough to know they didn't want to be particularly close to any other white fellows, because generally white fellows stuff things up. Worse, well, I'll get to some examples of what they did. It was about 640 acres of land, which is big. Imagine if they'd been given it and kept it. It'd be worth a fortune. Now, free settlement in Moreton Bay, because you recall the convict settlement was coming to an end. By 1837, the number of convicts had been reduced to 300, and by 1839, all of the female convicts had been removed, leaving only 94 male convicts. Moreton Bay ceased to be a penal settlement in 1839, and in 42 it was declared open for free settlement. This is a later map, 1842, that shows where the station was. Now, those of you that have done a little bit of history, hand up if you've heard of the Mile Creek Massacre. Okay, that was 1836 or 1838, one or the other, I can't remember off the top of my head. But what was happening was the local indigenous people were being dispersed, was the word. That was code language, of course, for being moved on however you needed to do it, and it wasn't generally done by the government. The government had little people they'd call free settlers and things, and they'd send them out and they'd give them land, and it was pretty much up to them. And you can imagine the average bloke who was, you know, armed and wandering around and scared because there were lots of conflicts going on. You never knew how long you were going to last. When you're scared of something, you generally hate it, and the hatred built between people, and it ended badly. So in those 1800s, there was all kinds of things going on. And the significance of the Mile Creek Massacre isn't that it was a massacre. It was the first massacre that the white fellas were held accountable for what they did. So, and all that happened was that the situation went underground. And if you go a bit further north or a bit further west, the further you are away from the law anyway, and this part of the world ended up being a long way from the law, which was very convenient for those with the best fighting technology. In 1842, there was an incident at Kilcoy. Has anyone heard of that one? Yeah, lots of... strychnine was mixed in with some food that was left for the local people to consume. And they were trying to get to the Bunya Mountains out through Kilcoy and up that way to the Downs and places like that. So it was seen as a good route. And our missionary people, they often trekked that way and had tried to set up mission outposts, one at Burpengary. One of the missionaries was speared in the leg and reportedly hobbled and crawled all the way back to the main station, but continued to love the locals. You probably haven't heard of this one, but at Mount Witherin, which is at Canungra down here, there's a news article you can read about activities with the native police and how they dispersed the locals down there a few years later. It was going on all over the place. You might have heard of Leichhardt, explorer, Ludwig. So he actually stayed with the missionaries for 3 months in 1842, I think. That was before his claim to fame expedition, the successful one, where he went from the Darling Downs to an island just off Darwin. And I should know the name of that island, but he didn't go to Darwin. He went to there was an outpost already on this island. Danny, do you know what that island was? No? Sorry, did I wake you up? No. Not sure. It was one of them very close to Darwin. Yeah. Who knows what happened to Leichhardt on his second journey? If you did, you'd be ahead of the rest of us because he disappeared. That's right. He was on his way to Perth. He was optimistic. From Darling Downs to Perth. How would you like walking that sometime? Man. Now, in 1844, some more missionaries were sent out. These are another four names that ended up coming to reinforce the mission station at Nunda. Now, this is a bit hard to understand, but this is a map that was drawn in 1846 of the German station, as it was called, which was the missionary base. That row of things along the top, they're houses that they built. They built them all in a row. And the blocks, they gave each other, they set aside blocks of land that were all the same shape, and they were real long ones like this. They had little front yards, and in the front they planted decorative plants, and in the back was hopefully enough to eat. They got into cropping very, very early on because, as I say, there was no shop. So if you don't grow it, you don't eat it. Their approach to interaction with the locals was probably improved on the average English approach to the locals. The English, my take is that they had a more of a superior kind of attitude. The Prussians and Germans had a more interested attitude from my reading. I could be wrong on that, so don't quote me. But they were still very, very tied to their culture. So they showed up where these people have lived for a very long time, and they said, basically, we're here now, we can teach you how to farm, we can educate you with schools, we can help you put up fences, keep your animals contained, and things like that. And do you think the locals were interested in any of those things? Why would you? When your whole life you've wandered around, you eat what you want. Admittedly, you get hungry. Admittedly, you fall over and break your hip, and that's pretty much the end. But they'd seen it all before. It was a way of, you just accepted it. So that's been one of the big barriers to local missions here, is that I don't think we were able to offer something that was tangible and understandable enough to be enticing. Interestingly too, when I was growing up, my dad used to mention this idea that the local indigenous people, some of them may have been cannibals, and I was skeptical, I've got to tell you. But in some of the things that I've read, there's information that gets dropped around the edges that makes it believable. So I don't know, I mean, obviously stuff happens in places, one-offs happen in places, but I remember reading about the last of the local one Jerryborough full-blood guys who lived here in the Albert River, the bottom of the hill. He's buried at the Anglican church down here. His name was Bullum. He died in 1931, and he claimed that the people in the one Jerryborough clan had given up cannibalism long ago, but the Brisbane clans were still into it, and that was one of the reasons that they were at war with the Brisbane mob. And there's obviously more than one Brisbane mob, so I can't tell you which one he was talking about. And also in the documents that I've read, some of the white people were, because they were the only ones writing stuff down, they were writing the occasional story about it too. How much of that was built on fear or misunderstanding or whatever, who would know? But the issue was there. One of them suggests that one of the missionaries asked if he was at risk of being eaten and was told, no, he's not, they don't like the taste of white people. So after the missionaries arrived, things were very tough at the mission station. Government funding was withdrawn within a couple of years. And when you miss out on your ration from Brisbane that was being brought in from Sydney, it becomes very hard. So they too were hungry, and hunger drove them to posture towards the indigenous people that was probably more stressed than it should have been. There's a report that the local indigenous people used to come and feed in their lovely backyards, of course, because there was food there, and flog the animals. And when the missionaries would gather for their church service, they had a bell that they'd ring, which was a sign for them to gather. It was also a sign for the locals to come and flog whatever they wanted. And when you're starving to death and you're watching people flog your means of survival, it's not good. And at one point, a firearm was aimed above the heads of some locals to frighten them away. That's a story. But it's very hard to convince, you can imagine the stress of the situation of having being at war, and then you're trying just to say, shoo, go away, and you shoot the same weapon in the same direction. It's not great. So the mission, most of the missionaries went from being foundation, from being mission focused. They were very hungry. They became market gardeners because they had to do that from the start anyway. And by the time the mission closed down, they became local pioneers. And very, very good local pioneers, I might add, as well. That's where the property was, that circle inside there. It says German missionaries. And that was, I think, in the 1844 map. So after free settlement, they started taking out blocks and selling them off or leasing them out or doing pastoral runs and things. Here's a few places that you can still see the signs of those guys today. The suburb of Zillmere was named after one of them, Zillman. This is only a limited list, by the way. Gerler Road at Hendra. Franz Road, Clayfield. Wagner Road, Clayfield. Nick. How do you pronounce that? Nick? Okay. Redcliffe. Houseman. Now, he's got a real fascinating story. He's the one that was speared in the leg up near Burpengary. He's got an interesting story because he went away and then came back as a missionary for a second go here in the Logan and Albert River area. That's John Dunmore Lang. No, just kidding. That's Wally Lewis. But the old cemetery reserve at Paddington, having been converted into Lang Park, the name is a compliment to the late Reverend John Dunmore Lang, who in the 50s of the last century did so much in the advancement of Australia and especially for Queensland. Whoever wrote this article didn't know about the 30s and the 20s and the 40s, obviously. Many thousands of people, the great mass of the historically uninformed, will have never heard of the name Lang Park being given to the reserves and wondered why. Perhaps someday, when our sterling pioneers have been dead long enough to be canonised, some memorial will be erected to their memory and a statue of the late Dr. Lang in the park, which now bears his name, may inspire the young generation to a keener desire to understand the history of the settlement. There's some more. Now, Rodie Road, that's where the Prince Charles Hospital is. Franz Rodie was one of those originals. And that's a couple of drawings of Franz and his wife, Julia. And I don't know if you've noticed something interesting about this weekend. So you can go and have a look at the graves at the Nunda Cemetery, and the Nunda Historical Society has loads of info. And a couple of people have written PhDs on this story that I've drawn quite heavily. You can look up one from Griffith and one from the University of Sunshine Coast that I only just found out the other day.
Did I have Nunda for its name?
Nunda, I think it was an indigenous name.
What happened was
what? You know the story?
The missionary sent one of his black boys out to get some cattle. He came back and said, "None there, wash none there."
Good, good, good. That brings me about to the end, with the exception of one fun fact, and that is that the Franz Rodie fella, he died in 1903. So he lived from about 1810 to 1903. He died at West End, and his great-grandson had memories of him, and in the 1950s, his great-grandson described him as an old man who would sit at the kitchen bench on a stool every day. He'd read his Bible, and he'd meditate and pray, and he said very little. And I just thought, it's a good picture of what we can all do. But he saw some things in life, I tell you. That same guy, Franz Rohde, is my great, great, great granddad. So that's how I know a little bit about him. No, that's a true story. So thanks very much. That's the end of my presentation. Thanks for coming. I'm really shocked that you came.